The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey there, how are you? I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. It's time a little bit late, but we're on time for this week's News Dissector Radio Hour here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Every week at this time, I try to amplify on some of the issues I write in my blog at newsdissector.com. Try to get into some of the political and other questions of the day, as well as talk with some people who are usually pretty informed about what's happening. We're doing it again today. We're talking and focusing on the media. We're going to be meeting in a little bit with the director of the film Programming the Nation, which opens at the Quad tonight. And in a moment, we're going to hear from Thomas Cooper, who teaches at Emerson College in Boston, who's a media expert and specialist, and is involved in a new program, an attempt at a media fast, which he wants to tell us about. He has a book out called Fast Media and Media Fast. So a lot of issues about the media, not only what's wrong with it, but what you can do about it. Some people feel there's not much you can do about it. Other people complain and protest it. Tom's book on the media fast basically says tune it out. And we're going to hear more from him in a few seconds here on News Dissector Radio. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector.
Coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the wars against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA. Coming from the sorrow in the street, the holy places where the races meet, from the homicidal bitchin' that goes down in every kitchen to determine who will serve and who will eat. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery of change, and it's here they got the spiritual.
The Spiritual Thirst. That's Leonard Cohen. The song is Democracy. It's Democracy is Coming to the USA. It's really a beautiful poem. He's done it on a whole bunch of different versions. There's a version on YouTube and a number of other outlets. Of course, his name is now prominently on a plaque outside the Chelsea Hotel on 23rd Street in New York, but we don't know how long that will last because he wrote the song about the Chelsea Hotel. But the Chelsea Hotel has been sold to a developer, and in the course of being sold, its future is extremely uncertain, and that's one of the concerns people in Chelsea have, people in America have, because the Chelsea Hotel is in a sense, has been a symbol, a monument to a certain kind of bohemian lifestyle, which is now being threatened by the same forces that are threatening everything, which is the powerful forces of great wealth and irresponsibility. And so we have a new company that's taken over the hotel that hasn't communicated with the people who live there, hasn't communicated with the guests, doesn't seem to feel it has to. It's an issue that is very prevalent in our country, this whole question of responsibility and irresponsibility. Tom Cooper, are you with me?
Hey, Danny. I used to have a great student with that name at Emerson College. I wonder if you're related.
Well, I'm not related, but I did speak at Emerson College a bunch of times when I was the news dissector on WBCN in Boston. I also worked at Channel 5, also worked at Channel 2. So I'm I'm a Boston person to some degree, at least spiritually, and a follower of your work as well. And, of course, one of the issues that we need to discuss, and you know, is the whole question of responsibility in the media. You've been tracking the media for many years. You've been analyzing it in terms of various studies, looking at ethics, the lack of ethics in the media. I wonder if you could, and now you've written this new book, which we'll like to get to in a minute, but I'd like you to sort of summarize, you know, your many years of being a media analyst and scholar. What have you discovered about our media system here in the U.S. of A.?
Thank you. It's a privilege to be on the air. I want to make it first clear that I'm not a total media basher, because you're doing a great job and many other people are doing a great job with the media to make us think. I'm only concerned about the excessive flash, trash, clash, for cash syndrome and the excessive degree of mind control that goes on when people aren't careful with their media consumption. So what I've done in the field of ethics is work with a lot of specific parts of ethics, but also compile the views of Americans who are concerned. When we put all the leading surveys together just a few years ago, their primary concerns with the media were truthfulness, this is in the United States now, excess, such as excessive violence available to children, excessive sexuality available to children, et cetera, and privacy was the third leading concern. I've also been just putting together all of the studies that are pertinent and germane about children and the media. And the aggregate concern, if you put all of this together, is that the greater the excessive consumption of mainstream entertainment media, the higher the odds a child will become obese, ADD, alcohol or tobacco dependent, academically mediocre or poor, housebound, prematurely sexually active or pregnant, violent, or and distant, if not alienated from parents and peers.
So what you're saying, if I can jump in for a second, what you seem to be saying here is the media represents a clear and present danger, a threat to our culture, not an enabler of something better in our culture by and large. I mean, you offer some statistics from a magazine called Pediatrics in 2010 that looked at hundreds of studies from the past 50 years and found that by age 18, the average adolescent will have seen an estimated 200,000 acts of violence on television alone, and depictions of violence are prevalent in video games. There's a significant connection between exposure to violence in media and real-life violent behavior. Youth exposed to sexual content are at moderately higher risk for earlier sexual behavior, unplanned pregnancy, particularly when exposed to pornography. So those are some findings in your new book, but of course this stuff we so supposedly know. But what is the response of the media industry to all of this analysis and all of this critique? I come out of the media industry. I worked in media in Boston full-time in commercial media. I worked at ABC News here in New York at 2020. I worked at CNN as part of the startup team. So I have had personal experience and exposure to being on the inside. But what do the people who run media say to people like you when you raise these questions?
I can't speak for all of them, obviously, and I haven't spoken with all of them, but based on the spectrum of people I've spoken to, some choose to ignore it totally because it's uncomfortable and threatening. Others choose to work on specific issues, either because those are not threatening or because they personally have concerns with those issues. When I speak to them as parents, they usually have to open up and say, wait a minute, my own children are involved in this, and so they often speak in a different way than they speak as a corporate executive, and so I find common ground that way. Just about all of them have found the concern with excessive violence to be valid to some degree, although some will hide behind the First Amendment and say this is not really a serious concern because, after all, we've had this sort of thing in life throughout, long before we had media. We had violence and children were exposed to it and so forth. So there's a variety of perspectives out there, but I'd say we often take the perspective that serves our best self-interest, and many people adopt a perspective that says this is not as bad as it seems.
You know, my experience here is that basically media executives tend to ridicule, denigrate, deny, dismiss accusations of improper behavior by their own programming. They say, listen, nobody's really influenced to it. If you don't like it, you can just click on another channel. You don't have to watch it. Many people do that. Why blame us? You know, it's the viewer's responsibility. Then these same people who deny that media has any influence then turn around when they're selling advertising and they pitch advertisers. They say, you know, people who watch our ads buy more of your products. Our ads are very effective in selling what you're offering, and therefore it's a very powerful powerful medium that you have to pay us a lot of money to become part of if you want to increase your sales. So they have it both ways. They're you know, challenging anybody who comes at them with a moral, political, or scholarly objection, and then they're embracing the same kind of sales pitch when it's in their interest to do so. So I think you're quite valid on that.
Yeah, I've met people of exactly that description. I want to also say, though, that I avoid stereotyping by saying within every single profession I've worked in, just about, there are exceptions. They're people of integrity. They're people with leadership skills who really want to make a difference, who insist on a tight ethics code in their company. And yet there are many, just as you say, who are only interested in bottom line, only interested in adopting perspectives that further their own self-interest.
You know, I mean, I've had experiences with, you know, really good executives. I've done stories on networks that I'm proud of. I'm not, you know, tarring all this with one brush. I've written a book called The More You Watch, The Less You Know, which reflects my experience in the media. So I'm a critic, but I'm also a media maker. I'm involved in media because I think it's important. I think it also needs to be challenged. I write the NewsDissector.com blog every single day, which offers usually some critique not only of media commission, but media omission, what's not in the media, information that you can find in other countries that you often can't find in our own. So I agree with you there. But I also find that there's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy. You know, I worked at ABC in the years when it was bought by Disney, you know, supposedly a network that really cared about children. And, you know, at the company, they created a series called Children First. And it was stories about, you know, parents, children, and teachers who are trying to help empower kids to be able to solve problems and the like. And we produced this series for ABC, and we were proud to do so. But then what we found was that many of the stations didn't take it. It was offered to them for free. They weren't required to run it, so therefore they didn't run it because they weren't going to be making money running it. And as a consequence, it got on the air in a few places, but not in many. You know, even though the people at the company really wanted to bring this content out to the public, but the programmers didn't want to actually make it part of the programming schedule. So all this work and all of these great shows, you know, were seen by a, you know, very small audience, in part because ABC didn't get behind it and promote it, even though they did make it. So you have, you know, what I call sort of a level of hypocrisy here, where, you know, where they will pay lip service to certain values, but in the end, they go with their bread and butter, whatever that might be. Some of it might be positive content, you never know, but a lot of it is really dangerous content.
Oh, and you and I are on the same page about the concerns, the very long list of increasing concerns that not only we have, many other people have. But I did want to be balanced by saying most of us have seen a movie that changed our life or made us rethink, or we've heard a song that inspired us, or on television there was a program that made us see something a little differently. Perhaps it was an inspirational speaker. Perhaps it's someone like you who was bringing up another point of view. Perhaps it was a talk show where several perspectives forced us to see something in a new light. So I do want to say the media has great potential, and some people actualize it. Unfortunately, the majority are going with the mainstream tendency to appeal to the lowest common denominator and to let money lead rather than intelligence.
Well, you know,
so
Tom,
I understand.
Tom, after all these years, you know, as a defender of media freedom, that's why we created MediaChannel.org, as a defender of, you know, my colleagues and journalists who are struggling to get the news out in many countries and are at risk, have been killed, have been wounded, and all the rest of it. Of course, I support a positive media, but I have to ask the question, is our media serving our democracy, you know, or is it in fact a threat to our democracy? Is it in fact, when you watch Jon Stewart, as I did last night, show the debate that's taking place over, you know, budget cutbacks, where protecting, you know, the wealthiest people in America from having to pay more taxes in the name of opposing class warfare, you know, basically, and willing to take, you know, the most money as possible from the poorest people who can't even afford to pay taxes because they don't even make any income enough to actually qualify to pay taxes. And this sort of thing goes on systematically. In other words, what I'm saying to you, Tom, is this is an institutional problem. It's not an individual problem. It's not like, yeah, there are good people in the media. I think I was one of them. There are other executives. Certainly, we tried very hard, and sometimes we succeeded. But as an institution, you know, we can say the military does good things, but looking at the wars that we've waged and looking at the trail of victims across the world, you know, on balance, as the term you used, you know, we have to raise some questions. Is this really helping humanity, or is it damaging and harming humanity? And these are the kinds of questions that I've come to. But you've offered up an interesting, if not a solution, certainly something that we could do that might give us some time to reflect on these questions more deeply than simply treat it as an argument which you either agree with or disagree with. And this is in your new book called Fast Media, Media Fast. And you're actually talking about an age of media overload. We all can identify with that, you know, particularly now that we all have portable phones and iPads and, you know, and all kinds of devices to get information in, endless apps and other information. Are we basically over-mediaing ourselves? You know, what is your idea here of a media fast?
Great. In the classroom, I noticed that if I would ask my students, how many of you have a strong opinion of Obama? They'd all raise their hands. I'd ask them, how many have a strong opinion of bin Laden? They'd raise their hands. How many of you have a strong opinion of Lady Gaga? They'd raise their hands. I'd say, how many of you have spent 8 hours with any of these people off camera to see what they're really like? None of them would raise their hands. So this began to get me thinking about the fact that we all often live in a dream world where we think we know things, but what we know is what the media told us about those things. And what we know may be a conglomerate of images, sound bites, abbreviated versions of somebody else's secondhand view of, but it's not firsthand experience, and it's not something we've researched personally. So I suggested to take a look at our quality of thought, that we actually, as students, and I did it first because I believe in doing what I ask other people to do, take something I call the media fast, which is to abstain from any media that's a guilty pleasure, not from essential media that you need to keep your job or to stay safe, but to leave behind guilty pleasures for a week or 3 weeks or a month or whatever is practical for a person, and look at their thinking in a new way. I also said if that's not possible, take a media diet, just like a food diet. Cut out the parts of it that you think are not working for you, or you think you're addicted to, or you think you're mindlessly consuming. Cut back on those just as you would with a food diet. And then the third group, a control group, actually inspects their own media habits. They get in a car and they blindly turn on the radio. They have to make a note about that. Or they start waking up in the morning and singing, you know, I'm Katy Perry's Teenage Dream, which they may not be. I sing I'm a Material Girl, which I'm clearly not. You have to make a note about that as well, so that you begin to closely inspect all the ways that you're thinking that aren't your way of thinking, but that are programmed in from the outside in. And my question to people is, who are you under the programming? Isn't that the essence of democracy? What is your own spirit? How is it that you see the world, not what you're told or homogenized into thinking? And so this experiment has grown over the years. Not only have classes done it, senior citizens have done it, community groups have done it, families have done it.
And what do they tell you when they, quote, do it?
A lot of people have withdrawal symptoms at the beginning, just as you would with a food diet or a food fast. You know, there's a kind of I'm reliant on this for the next dose feeling that some people go through. But eventually about four-fifths of them come out with some kind of benefits, which are, one, I'm thinking for myself again. Two, I'm saving a lot of time because I put 8 hours into the media day or whatever it might be. Three, I've actually begun to repair some of my relationships because people aren't screaming at me, get off your handheld, or don't say you can't talk to me until the commercial. I'm a person too. So, in fact, we notice now divorce lawyers are telling us a major reason that people are citing for increased divorces is the media. He's always on porn, she's always, you know, texting her friends, and they can't talk to each other. So, relationships are often a beneficial aspect of this. People come out of it also with more protection of the environment. they suddenly realize all the money that we're spending on media that consumes more and more of the environment. Every newspaper, for example, is another small forest, just as one example. Another example is the oil that was protested down in the Gulf. We were all concerned about that. A lot of op-eds were written, a lot of stories were written. Well, the ink that's used for those is petroleum-based, so more oil was spent commenting on the situation, another 20% worldwide. So we're constantly saving the environment when we fast or diet. We're saving money. We're saving time. And most importantly, we're saving ourselves and our own ability to make choices.
Right. Well, you know, there's a new study that's just come out. I don't know if you saw this one, basically saying that if at age 25, if you're consuming hours of media a day, you are actually shortening your life. That actually there's a verifiable connection between over consumption of media and your health. And this is something which isn't commented on very much on the media. And, of course, I'm taking a risk here, Tom, on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, having you on, telling our listeners to stop, you know, getting tuning in. You know, I hope that they can find a balanced way to deal with this. But this book is, I found, very important, very well written. Gaita Press out of Boulder, Colorado, Fast Media, Media Fast. It's endorsed by, among others, two people that I know and respect, Robert Gardner, who's a filmmaker from Harvard, Gene Kilbourne, who's done a lot of writing about how advertising, in a way, oppresses women, and they find it valuable. I do as well. Thank you so much for coming on. We will have a podcast of this show, which I'll send you if you'd like to share it on any of your websites or other media outlet. So this is a pleasure to actually meet and talk with you. We're going to be talking more about media and about subliminal media with the director of a new film that's opening in New York called Programming the Nation. You know it's probably good because it's been trashed by the New York Times today. So, you know, basically dismissed, you know, it's a bunch of old people talking about the media, blah, 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 blah. It's opening at the Quad Theater. The director will be joining us in a few minutes. But here's a little comment on an issue that our media does not give enough attention to, the homeless. Allen Ginsberg, please.
I dreamt I dwelled in a homeless place where I was lost alone. Looked right through me into space and passed with eyes of stone. Oh, homeless hand on many a street, accept this change from me. A friendly smile or word is sweet as fearless charity. Woe working man who hears the cry and cannot spare a dime. Nor look into a homeless eye, afraid to give the time.
Damaged world. I bought a bourgeois house in the Hollywood Hills, a trunk load of $100,000 bills. Man came by to hook up my cable TV. We settled in for the night, my baby and me. We switched round and round till at last dawn. There was 57 channels and nothing on.
Thank you, Mr. Springsteen, for your contribution, your critique of media, 57 channels, nothing's on. That's from a special version that was done at the time of the L.A. riots and the L.A. looting, somewhat appropriate to what's been happening in England. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The number here to call in is 888-874-4888. We are talking about the media in this particular show with from different angles, different points of view. Our next guest joining us now is Jeff Warrick, the director of a new film called Programming the Nation. And it's a film that opens tonight at the Quad Theater here in New York City. It's an analysis, really, of subliminal messaging in America. Apparently, according to many authorities, since the late 50s, subliminal content has been tested and delivered through all forms of mass media, including Hollywood films and, of course, other media outlets as well. I'm more concerned with the less subliminal aspects of the media myself, but I do think this is an important subject. I'm going to be actually speaking this weekend. I forget when exactly, Jeff. Maybe you can remind me. At the Quad Theater, there's going to be a Q&A after the screening of one of your films, and I'd be happy to be there. You have a number of people in the film: Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, Doug Rushkoff, and others commenting on all of this. And of course, this has led the New York Times and all of its might, insight, and wisdom to dismiss the film out of hand because you have a bunch of old people, on camera, which is, you know, if the Times liked it, I wouldn't be having you on. So tell me a little bit about Programming the Nation. What is your thesis?
Well, the thesis is basically, the movie started with after post 9/11, I think, when the beating of the drum for war was taking place with the mainstream media, or what I prefer to call the extreme media, pushing for us to go to war against Iraq. So I was looking at this and I was seeing how people were kind of falling in line with that notion. Also, how the media was really good at juxtaposing, Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and 9/11 and terrorism, even though there was no. There's no proof that they're ever involved in 9/11 or terrorism, and had weapons of mass destruction.
And Mr. Hitler, let us not forget, Time Magazine took out the cover that Hitler had been on in Time Magazine in the late 30s.
Yeah.
And they reused it with Bin Laden. The idea being, that sort of Saddam is Hitler or Bin Laden is Hitler or Hitler is everywhere. This sort of comparison, taking something that people know about and have heard of and are frightened of, and then linking it to something else and suggesting there's a direct connection, a direct parallel. I don't know how subliminal it is, but it certainly seems to be effective.
I don't know how subliminal it all is either. I mean, that was just kind of the catalyst for me. The film does look at the history of subliminal messaging, and maybe it was a bit overambitious of me to try to include, current issues into a film like that, but I thought that would be important. It was relevant, and that's kind of how I wanted to pursue it. If I could find examples of subtle techniques that were being used, not necessarily subliminal, but I think there's a lot of examples of that in mass media, not just with what happened after 9/11, but that was the most critical one for me. That was kind of the catalyst for me to say, okay, this is something that's important that I'm going to embark upon.
Well, let's take another word that's in the title of your film, programming.
There you go.
In what way can we say the media programs us? The other day I was having a breakfast with Mike Swig, who teaches out at Stony Brook, who's an author of a book called The Working Class Majority, very interesting analyst and author of class politics. And he said that, Karl Marx's notion of working class consciousness would be very different if he knew that in every living room, in everybody's house, there's this little box which is projecting the ideology, the worldview, and the information favored by the ruling classes of the day, and in a sense programming the people who live in those homes. In what way is programming of the right concept?
Well, I mean, Marshall McLuhan probably put it best in his book. In the medium is the message, right? It's how are we programmed? It's just so rampant. There's so many ways in which we're being programmed through mass media. If we just look at things like, for example, anorexia and obesity. One of our experts alludes to the fact that this is a media-driven event. And I would tend to agree with that. And if you also look at things like attention deficit disorder in our country, I think you could probably trace some of that to media. But, I mean, aside from the psychological disorders and eating disorders and things that media kind of creates in people, I think it has a tendency just to create nervousness, anxiety. Its goal is probably to keep us just out of the hair of and out of the way of people that are making decisions so that we're just kind of dumbed down. We're entertained, so we're lazy, lethargic, uneducated, and also very fearful. It creates a lot of fear in people. They use fear tactics to sell things, to just sell people into watching. And let's face it, people tune in when there's something, when there's a heightened sense of alert or fear of something going on. First,
not according to the New York Times this morning in their review of your film. They're suggesting that it's your critique that is at fault here, not the media.
Of course. And you know what? I would expect that coming from the New York Times. I mean, they're part of the mass media, right? So of course they don't like being examined with such scrutiny.
Well, there you go. I mean, this is a big problem, trying to have a discourse about media, trying to have a debate about media, when the media itself is totally engaged in the debate by being dismissive, by and large, of critics. You know, this is why, in a sense, The Daily Show has done such a good job in calling our attention to how certain message points get reinforced and repeated and recycled on network after network and program after the program, as if it was true. I mean, they did a little bit last night that was really brilliant about so-called class warfare, how right-wing commentators are dismissing concerns that the wealthy should pay more taxes by labeling it class warfare and suggesting that they're demonizing the people who are actually creating wealth in the society, when in fact the whole economy is in the doldrums right now, thanks to these people, and may never recover. We don't know. So, this is certainly an example of this. But it seems like, and this is, I guess, my question, we have to move on because of the financial crisis, Jeff, that's happening. And we have an expert standing by from the ML Implode website who's going to help inform us about it. But just, in closing, why should people come see your film? What are you hoping will come out of this? Because I'm very enthusiastic about it, and I'm so happy that you could come on.
Well, whether you believe in subliminal messaging or not, I don't think that's necessarily the point. The point is to create a heightened sense of consciousness and more awareness, more media literacy on the tactics that they use. And I definitely think that no matter where you land on which side of the coin, whether when it comes to subliminal messaging, people will definitely never look at mass media the same way again.
I have a subliminal message coming out at you right now. Kat Waters is in the studio. She is closing her eyes, and she is sending out a message basically to turn, overthrow the Federal Reserve Bank. That's the message she's sending.
Oh, no.
And I'm sure that many of our listeners are getting that message, even though she hasn't said a word. But if you just get the vibe of it, I think you will accept that view and that point. She was at a protest last week, which we told you about. Quite a few people came came out. There is more of a focus on these issues. Jeff Warrick, thank you very much for coming on. I hope to meet you at the Quad Quad Cinema. It's going
to
be Sunday evening when I'm going to be after the 7 o'clock show, I believe.
Correct.
Involved in a Q&A with you and try to, you know, basically defend the New York Times, which, of course, according to the New York Times, needs no defense ever. You know, but thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing you.
Okay, just to segue now into this financial crisis, which continues. Aaron Crown, a regular analyst commentator from MLImplode.com, is with us. Good morning, good afternoon, good day, Aaron, for being here. We're going to get into some of these issues. I mean, I have to tell you, last night I was surprised when I got a call from Melbourne, Australia, from, you know, the ABC network, the biggest network in Australia, to comment on the financial crisis, okay? You know, I haven't gotten any call from CNBC where I actually worked, you know, or ABC where I worked, or CNN where I worked. They're not interested, but I did get a call from Melbourne, Australia, and I do have a piece up on the Al Jazeera website about financial issues for which I write regularly. So clearly there are people interested in the kinds of other perspectives about all of this. I wanted to just, you know, before we get into these issues, I wanted to, you know, basically wish a big happy birthday to Leon D. Black. Leon is a big, you know, financial billionaire buyout titan, and he threw himself a little party last Saturday night in Southampton, which I don't think you were invited to. I certainly was, and it was a buffet dinner featuring seared foie gras, food stations, 200 guests, a show by Elton John, who sang Crocodile Rock, okay, and was paid at least $1 million for the performance. You know, I could see a crocodile sort of eating Mr. Black. That would be something I would pay to see. But at any rate, this is another example of big executives spending lavishly, you know, to honor themselves and celebrate their wealth. And this happened on Long Island, and among those present at this particular event was not only the chief executive of Goldman Sachs and the head of the Blackstone Group, but our own Mayor Michael Bloomberg, Senator Charles Schumer, and Martha Stewart, and our great cultural asset Howard Stern, all there to celebrate with Mr. Leon Black, one of the people who undoubtedly played some role in bringing down the economy. Now we have a situation where stocks were falling anew. There are new fears about European banks. There's been a sell-off overseas. I don't know what the word is this morning, but one of the ironies of it, of course, is that all these troubled investors rushed into U.S. Treasuries as a safe haven, okay, despite all of the criticisms of government debt. They're kind of adding to the government debt here to protect themselves, so much for the consistency of their arguments. Meanwhile, there's been a report that the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, actually has been destroying documents, and, you know, and rather than investigating what it should be investigating, basically destroying the investigative information. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is really big, Danny. I'm glad that you brought that up. So the story was broken, at least in a big way, by Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone. I recommend everybody read the article just to get a full flavor of it.
Matt Taibbi on Rolling Stone, yeah.
That's right, yeah. This is something that I and many others had suspected was going on in some shape or form for a long time, because it was apparent to all of us, I mean, you included for sure, that the SEC and the other federal regulators are basically letting the big guys off with either no punishment or minor slap on the wrist, while basically going after the little guys and the small timers and trumping their numbers in terms of catching those types. Well, this new item that came out, which is based on a SEC whistleblower, an attorney named Darcy Flynn, who's 13 years at SEC, it blew the whistle under the provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act, the new law, and basically has revealed that the SEC was systematically destroying its documents of preliminary investigations. I believe it was over 9,000 files. And these cover basically all the big names, including Madoff. And these go back to 1993, as far as this whistleblower has reported. So I'm basically considering this kind of the Rosetta Stone of the security side of the financial crisis and the bubble that led up to it. Because this basically proves that the regulators are letting the big guys off, and it shows you a way that they've actually been doing that. Because, you know, when they go into an investigation and decide not to prosecute and then destroy the files, no one can ever call them out on it, you know, short of a whistleblower. And, of course, now all we know is that the files are gone.
So, so basically the corruption, you know, stinks from the, what is about that saying about the fish, stinks from the head, you know? There seems to be a pattern here, a very deep institutional pattern, irrespective of political administration. Bush administration,
right.
Obama administration, doesn't matter. Democrats, Republicans, they all seem to be in the business of protection racket, a protection
that's
racket
right.
of the Wall Street banksters and the people who are making the big money even when everybody else is losing money. And here we have a situation where the agency that was supposed to be investigating, not only wasn't investigating, but was covering up, now destroying documents. And now we have a whole debate going on. I was reading about this yesterday, where the industry, the financial industry, is sniping away at the Dodd-Frank Act, trying to essentially weaken any possible regulation, any possible restraint on their activities, and is, you know, has a full court press going against the government, against the whole regulatory regime. And, you know, so it's hard to think about how anything is ever going to change. I mean, you know, the market's collapsing, the economy back in the doldrums is something that was predicted by everyone, that unless there was, you know, legislation and regulation that, you know, broke up two, you know, big-to-fail banks and the like, this was going to happen again. And lo and behold, what is happening? It's happening again. Go ahead.
Yeah. I don't want to give the idea to people that, you know, I think everybody at the SEC is bad, everybody in the regulating institutions are bad. In fact, quite the opposite. I think most of the people that make up the rank and file that are actually doing the work are good people just trying to do their job and doing a good job. But, you know, in things like this issue at the SEC, their superiors going probably to the highest levels are ordering them not to do their job. And generally making it miserable for them if they try to blow the whistle or try to do the right thing over those orders. So, like you said, you know, the fish rots from the head, and that is a huge, huge problem in our federal government. And it's frankly, it's a problem because all these institutions and the government itself have been bought off by the powerful interests, and unfortunately, we have allowed that to happen. And I'm glad to see things like this come out, but I hope that people really let it sink in and start to get out there and protest.
Well, notice where it is coming out. It's coming out in Rolling Stone magazine. It's not coming out, you know, on the front page of the Washington Post. And, you know, so the people who are closest to the regulators, in a way, are doing the least to expose, investigate, in essence, inform us about what's really going on. They're asleep at the switch. This is media complicity to financial terrorism, basically. And, you know, it's been a pattern. I write about it in my book, The Crime of Our Time. I focus on it in my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com, if anyone's interested. I'm trying to get at these issues every week on the show by having you on, Aaron, you know, telling people about your website, mlimplode.com. But it's sort of one little voice, in a sense, up against, you know, a whole forest of Leon D. Blacks having Elton John sing to him in Southampton at a monstrous birthday party he throws in his own honor, presided over by none other than Howard Stern. OMG. OMG. That's a phrase that Irene would know because she's an incredible internet maven. Would you introduce yourself, sign in, please, and tell us what's happening? You're going to be following my show with a new show.
Wait,
here.
Wait, you just said replacing. If I replaced your show, I'd die a little inside, Danny. I'd okay. die.
All right, so you're not going to replace my show. I could always hope, right? But, you know, introduce yourself, if you would, and, you know, you're going to a new program coming to the Progressive Radio Network.com today, following this program with a woman who was a guest on my show just a few weeks ago, a great radio talent, a personality, a young voice, a what else should I say?
No, that's all perfect. I mean, I was just thinking how fantastic it is that you're going to have your show about media, and then I have my show about media. But when we were doing this all, it used to be so alternative. Well, not that internet radio is quite mainstream, but it is amazing.
It is extreme, yeah.
Yeah. It is extreme, exactly. Yeah, so I'm excited to talk again about media and media ethics and just sort of get into what we are seeing, what we're reading, what we're talking about, because it really does shape everything. And it's so funny. I had a friend earlier today that was like, well, you can't just say that the show's about media because that just means too much nowadays.
Yeah, you know, and if you use the phrase media literacy,
a lot
of people don't even recognize the word literacy because they're too illiterate to even know that the word literacy exists. So we're in an uphill fight here, an uphill battle to try to get the truth out. Irene is joining us here on PRN. I'm so happy to have you on today to, like, tell our listeners, you know, to don't change the dial, don't go away. Listen to the premiere of this new program.
Called
No One's Listening. All right. It can't be more ironic, more bizarre, and more on target than what we're offering you here. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. The website, PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and my own newsdissector.com will feature the URL for this podcast of this show, Radio Show that we've just done over the last hour for you to tune into and to share with your friends. So thanks for being with us another week here in August of the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you, Gary Knoll. Thank you, Irene. Thank you, listeners.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa, Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must. We